My first job actually was with Frank Gehry. I simply called him up at his office and said, Frank, I was really inspired by you. Can I come to work for you? And he said, no, there's no way. So I thought, well, there goes that. And the next day he called me back and said, somebody just quit and I need to fill that position right away.
Welcome back to Success Unscripted, the podcast where we peel back the curtain on real stories of success in the business world. I'm your host, Jonathan Israel, a financial advisor with Affinity Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services. To make my compliance officers happy, I'll mention that UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC. My office is located in Los Angeles, California, and I can be reached at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Today, I had an interesting conversation with Fred Fisher. Fred is an architect, widely known and respected in his field, and has worked on many prestigious projects such as MoMA PS1 in New York, Eric and Wendy Schmidt Hall at Princeton University, and the recent renovation of the Los Angeles Natural History Museum. This is a story of preserving the past, embracing the future, and challenging conventional wisdom. And after the interview, stay tuned for a short success story about someone you might know. Here's my conversation with Fred Fisher. Fred Fisher, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome, Jonathan. Good to see you.
It's good to see you. First, let's establish your reputation because it's such an honor to have you on. You might not be a household name, but you are a legendary architect known across the country. And you spent your formative years as a part of a group they called the LA School in the early 80s. Other architects included Tom Main, Frank Gehry. You've put your indelible stamp, not just on the architecture in LA, but I think across the world, and you as a group I'm talking about. And so can you talk a little bit about the LA School and what made you guys different?
Good question. The LA School was almost accidentally primarily located in Venice and Santa Monica. And at that time, that was one of the cores of the contemporary art world. And a number of us were interested in art, at least as much as architecture, and especially Frank Gehry, who I, in a sense, was my mentor. The group, in each in their own way, and this was in no way a unified, coordinated group of people, that it was a group that was trying to find a different set of meanings and form from this strict orthodox modernism, which was sort of the primary direction in architecture at that time. This was really before postmodernism came in, what came and went fairly quickly. But it was a number of individuals, each pursuing their own thing, but in a small area that in a way felt a certain camaraderie in our search.
Right. And so, yeah, I saw an article that talked about this. It said the LA School was and remains a group of individualized mavericks, all see themselves as outsiders on the margins, challenging the establishment with an informal and demanding architecture. So you guys all separately, but you worked with, I know you worked with Frank Gehry for a period of time too.
I did. When I graduated from UCLA School of Architecture, which was great for me, I had gone to Oberlin College, undergraduate, studied art and art history, and read a book that changed my outlook on life and art. And it was called Complexity and Contradiction by Robert Venturi, who became one of the guiding lights of postmodernism, although he vehemently denied being a postmodernist. But he talked about architecture in much more holistic terms, in terms of what the possible references were, and particularly looking back at history. And modernism was really a reaction to history in its origins in the early part of this 20th century. And he, in a way, opened the door again to look at history and see ideas and forms and philosophies that could be brought into the contemporary world. And I was very excited by that. And that led me to actually go to graduate school and pursue what was my father's profession, which I had avoided until then, and think maybe there was a place where I could bring together my interest in art and history and culture and the broad set of issues that a liberal arts school deals with into what I saw, and I think others saw, as an overly narrow focus of modern architecture.
So your father was an architect. Is that how you became interested in architecture?
It's how I became interested in it, but it didn't translate to me wanting to be an architect right away. As most Midwestern architects, Frank Lloyd Wright was his idol, and there were a number of books on Frank Lloyd Wright. So I read about architecture through that lens early on and loved it, embraced it, but didn't quite see myself doing that until I began to put the pieces together of art and architecture. And hearing Frank Gehry lecture, in a way, was the final piece in that puzzle, seeing how he was working with artists as clients, but also as inspiration for the forms and use of materials. And he was genuinely involved in the art community. People like Billy Al Bengston and Ron Davis and Ed Moses were his close friends, but also inspirations.
Maybe it's worth mentioning, if there's anyone who's not familiar with Frank Gehry, I mean, he's such a legendary name in the architecture world. He's built the Guggenheim in Bilbao, Spain. Loyola Law School is a Gehry project, the Walt Disney Concert Hall, of course. Besides the Concert Hall, which is such a phenomenal piece of architecture, there's actually a building that he designed in Dusseldorf, Germany, that I think is really quite interesting. Do you know the one I'm talking about? It's like the silver commercial, kind of curved commercial property.
I'm not familiar with that particular one.
Yeah, so I guess it actually earned a spot on the German edition of Monopoly. It became such an iconic building. So yeah, so kind of interesting. But you didn't grow up in LA, right?
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
In Cleveland, Ohio, and then you went to Oberlin, and then you drove out to go to UCLA grad school.
Yeah, I did what they called at that time auto drive-away, which is that you drive somebody else's car that needs it delivered across the country. And I came out here knowing nobody. It was not my idea of a city. I had lived in New York, and in a way, I thought that that might be where I would end up. But it was...
Why did you not think you'd end up in Los Angeles?
First of all, at the time, it was much more heavily polluted than it is now. I mean, it's hard to remember and realize the improvement in the air quality, literally.
Yeah.
And just this huge, sprawling city of stucco, dingbat apartment buildings. And I, not wisely, but I didn't buy a car for the first 3 years I was here. I rode my bike to UCLA and focused on my studies. And I didn't really appreciate or understand the city until I got a car. And then it sort of opened up. I began to understand it, that it offered so much. And at the time, it was really relatively easy to get around. And you had everything from the mountains to the deserts to the beaches. And as I began to practice almost accidentally, I realized it's still a frontier town, which I think it is today. It's a place where people go with ideas and who want to accomplish things, and that they're open to new ideas. And that sometimes I marvel at what people allowed me to do as a barely experienced practitioner. And I think that spirit of innovation, of building something from scratch, and certainly the overall embrace of nature here, I think, is a really important part of it. Just at the time when I could have left, I realized that actually there was something here for me.
Yeah, that's great. So you graduated from UCLA, and what was your first job?
No. I started, and I spent a couple of years with him. The office was quite small then. I think I was the sixth person in the office.
Wow.
He had been larger in the past when he was doing more corporate work for the Rouse Company. And I've always admired his bravery in that he pursued this very radical course in a difficult economic time when certainly everybody was trying to survive. And he was doing work that was not well accepted. And quite a number of the projects he designed at that time didn't get built. And yet he was absolutely committed to his personal artistic path. And I always admired and was inspired by that, while at the same time realizing that's not what I wanted to do. I was inspired by him and loved what he was doing, but that wasn't going to be me.
Okay.
So I realized that, you know, at a certain point, I need to go off on my own.
Okay. And you did that in 1981. You started your own practice.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, starting your own practice?
Maybe not the wisest thing I've done, but it was exciting and terrifying at the same time. Yeah. The classic case of setting up a drafting table in my garage and beginning to do tiny residential remodelings and studios for people in Venice. My first built project was a house, actually, that a classmate of mine had this commission. He was a longtime Angelino family, had a lot of contacts, and he was doing a house in Venice and decided when it was still in the design phase that he wanted to go to work for the architect Moshe Safdie in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And he basically handed the commission over to me. And it was for a man named Lauren Kaplan, who was the publisher of Wet Magazine, which was kind of a cult magazine at that time of the Venice culture. Okay. And it was called the Magazine of Gourmet Bathing. And
I can't admit to ever hearing about it.
The editor was a guy named Leonard Corin, and he was a classmate of ours at UCLA. And that was his graduate architecture thesis, was the first edition of this magazine, which tells you something about that class and that time.
Yeah. Was it hard initially to find clients when you were just starting out?
Sure.
Yeah.
But fortunately, the Venice creative community was kind of a tight-knit community. So I didn't do it strategically, but I became friends with artists because I was actually more interested in the art community than in the architecture community. So I would go to art openings and artist studios, and I lived in Venice. I was surrounded by artists. And so my next project was an artist studio for an artist named Elsa Rady, and I did her studio. And both of those projects garnered attention. Shockingly enough, my first house, literally before it was even finished construction, was published in Domus Magazine, which was one of the most prestigious international journals of design. And they were on to this Venice school very early on. And an editor came here and very quickly found who this group was and brought them together in a kind of a legendary issue of the magazine that had Frank Gehry's portrait on the cover.
Wow. So this is probably a good time to ask you, what kind of architecture does your firm specialize in?
There's two areas of primary focus. One of the things I really enjoy about our practice is that we do a wide range of things. And in the words of one of the great architects, Charles Moore, who I heard talk, the answer is always yes. And, you know, I'm curious, I want to meet people, I want to build, and so I will look at almost any kind of an opportunity that presents itself. But the art world and the residential world were really the core of our early practice, mm-hmm. doing artist studios, doing art galleries. My first institutional job was the Eli Broad Family Foundation facility, gallery, and offices in Ocean Park. And that was before the long before the one downtown. Eli was, you know, incredible person to work with and learn from. And this was a conversion of an old telephone company building, a historic building. Mm-hmm. And so the art world being a small world that it is, people began to respect what my particular approach to doing art spaces, which is, in a way, it seems obvious, but make the art look good.
Right.
And it's not about making an architectural statement.
Right.
It's about framing the art. So curators and artists respected what we did, and that led to a whole series of art spaces, one of the most famous of which is PS1 Contemporary Art Center in New York City, which was then later adopted by Museum of Modern Art. Now it's called MoMA PS1.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Yeah, so that's true, I guess, when it's not always about making an architectural statement. Like you said, you have clients and you create buildings to serve the needs of those clients. And so mm-hmm. I guess everyone can be a little bit different in that regard, right?
Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that I took from my father, is that he very strongly believed that architecture is a service profession. Mm-hmm. You're there to make people's lives better.
Right.
And he did hospitals his whole career, which is, that's a tough building type.
Yeah.
And he said that the most important person in the hospital is the person that's not in the room of the design. It's the patient. Mm-hmm. And so he saw himself as the advocate of the patient when the doctors had their needs, the nurses had their needs, the administration had their needs. He felt that somebody had to look out for the person who's really the subject of this. And that's what I've always built my focus on is, you know, and actually it's our firm mission is quite simple. It's improve life through architecture.
I like that. Tell me how you address themes of resilience and sustainability, not just environmental, but also in terms of client enjoyment and usage.
Well, that's become a really important stance. And I've actually touched on that very, very early. When I was still a student at UCLA for my capstone project, and this is where the third year students choose whatever they want to do, my father passed away that year. And I was grappling with that and almost, you know, just out of the blue came up with the idea of a solar powered crematory that would use solar energy for cremation. And so it was, in a way, it was a sustainable approach to that. And it had a lot of symbolism too of essentially dust to dust and using nature to be the ultimate disposition. And that ended up on the cover of a French architecture magazine when I was just a third year student in architecture school.
Did that ever come to fruition?
It never did, unfortunately. Okay. But that type of technology is used to generate electricity.
Yeah.
It's called a solar furnace, and you have mirrors that follow the sun and direct the sun and concentrate the sun at a point, and that boils water and creates energy. Yeah, well, I had that in the back of my mind, you know, literally since I began architecture. We had an opportunity later on in that we got a commission to do an addition to the city hall in Santa Monica. And the city of Santa Monica is very progressive. And partway through the design process, they decided to put a stake in the ground and say, let's go full living building challenge. There are many standards of sustainability out there. And living building challenge is arguably the highest and the most difficult to obtain. And they committed themselves to do it. It was not easy. It was not cheap. But we achieved that standard with that building. And the city now, essentially, it's net zero power, net zero water. And there are also other aspects of Living Building Challenge, such as wellness and beauty. And it's a very holistic approach to sustainability. It's not just getting the electricity use down low. And so that's become the largest public building to achieve that in the U.S.
Oh, wow. That sounds like it's a high threshold.
Very high threshold.
Who judges these?
Well, there
these
are
the certification process. Yeah,
there's LEED, there's Living Building Challenge, there's many others, and each one has its own nonprofit, which is a certifying agency, and they say this is the standard which we believe is the appropriate standard, and you choose to apply to that standard, and then if you meet their criteria, they give you the certification that you've achieved that. And I think that the agency that runs the Living Building Challenge is the Institute for Living Futures, ILFI.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. What's your favorite piece of architecture?
Well, there's so many. Certainly Frank Gehry's Disney Hall is one of them. I think that's a marvelous building. It's a masterpiece. It's in our hometown.
Yeah.
As a Midwesterner, Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, the house he did for the Kaufman family in Western Pennsylvania, I think is an incredible masterpiece. He did it, I think, when he was probably close to 90 years old, which is one of the things I like about architecture is they call it the old man's profession or the old person's profession, that Frank Gehry is in his, I think he's 90, close to 95 now.
Oh, is he?
And
does he still live in that house?
And still practicing. He built another house for himself. I actually worked on the famous house
in Venice,
Santa Monica.
Oh, in Santa Monica.
And then he just recently built another house on Adelaide. And that's where he lives now.
Oh, wow. How many people at your firm now?
At the moment, 20. We have 17 in Los Angeles and 3 in New York. We have a New York office because we have for many years done work in New York. And starting in 2006, we got a commission at Princeton to do a building. They were at the time building a lot. Princeton always builds a lot. And they were challenged by how much they were spending on buildings. And there's plenty of good architects on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. But a vice president at the time, he said he had my book on his shelf and he thought, you know, someday I want to give this firm a try. So we got an interview for this project. It was an interdisciplinary facility, operations research and financial engineering, which is as close as Princeton gets to a business school. Mm-hmm. And we won that job and we did that building and it was very successful, came in on time and on budget. And that has led to 18 straight years of work at Princeton. And we spent 10 years remodeling their main library. Princeton's Firestone Library is one of the great research libraries in the country. And we are just beginning construction on a 230,000 square foot computer science building. Computer science, oddly enough, is the largest major and the fastest growing major at Princeton. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to create a hub for that. And it's called Eric and Wendy Schmidt Hall. Mm-hmm. And it includes the renovation of a load-bearing brick Gothic Revival building from 1909 to complete gut renovation of that and adding to it what I would call a Silicon Valley style loft, heavy timber building. And again, this is sustainability, mass timber, high carbon sequestration, mm-hmm. and adding this loft building to it to create this large hub. And most of the students at Princeton will use that building because computers are now really part of studies everywhere. And yeah. with AI, even into the literature and areas that were formerly not connected to it. Now the beginning computer class at Princeton is the most registered class in the university.
Is it more challenging for you as an architect rather than just say, I don't know, you have like this empty plot of land where now you're going to take a very old historic structure yeah. and kind of reconfigure it?
That's a great question. I actually prefer that. And there's the reason which early on when I was studying art, I realized I was not made out to be an artist. The blank canvas, I don't respond to that. I need something to react to. And so to me, the more challenges, the more conditions that you encounter in an architecture project, the more interesting it is. Mm-hmm. And I like coming from back in the Robert Venturi complexity and contradiction thinking. I love that collision of new and old and yeah. of taking a historic building and adding to it and complementing it. And ironically enough, the site at the Princeton project, basically the new building is sandwiched between this beautiful Victorian Gothic Revival building and a Robert Venturi building.
Oh.
So in a way, I've come full circle to being inspired by Venturi in my approach to architecture and actually then physically encountering him on a project
wow,
at Princeton.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And there's a fun story about the building that you're located in here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Jonathan, I think that success is largely based on luck. And A. Quincy Jones was one of the most important mid-century architects in Southern California. And he built his own office building in 1954 on Santa Monica Boulevard, about a mile west of the freeway. And it's a beautiful mid-century courtyard office building. And all the architects know about it. And I was driving by it one day in the early 90s, and I saw a for sale sign on it. And I was shocked. He had passed away about 10 years earlier. The business had dwindled down to next to nothing. I knew his widow because she was kind of in the art world as well. And I called her up and said, Elaine, you know, what's going on? And she just needed to liquidate and the business wasn't really capable of maintaining the building. And so again, this was not the best timing financially, 1995, but I begged, borrowed everything from everybody I could and scraped together enough money to buy the building from her. And we very happily go to work every day in a mid-century masterpiece.
Wow.
And it inspires us. And people, literally everybody that comes in the building is inspired by us. The great ideas of mid-century modernism, which I at the beginning of the conversation in a way, rebelling against that was where I started. There are a lot of really important ideas there, one of which is connection to nature. And those buildings developed the notion of indoor-outdoor living, of making the garden as an integral part of the interior space you're living in. And that building is a perfect example of it. It's also got all the exposed construction, the wood construction. You see the beams and the structure. When you're in the building, you know how it's built, which is another aspect of modernism.
And did you make any changes to the building, or you kept it as is?
No, basically very minor cosmetic changes, one of which was in the work environment now, the kitchen, and I noticed it here in your office, the kitchen is really almost like in a home. The kitchen's the most important room. It's where people meet each other casually, and people gather for lunch. And it used to be just a tiny nook in the building back in the day. That was just, it was not seen that way in the 50s and 60s. We devoted one of the nicest spaces in the office, converting it from a workspace to a kitchen. And so everybody now reuses that, not only as a place to go for meals and snacks, but as a casual meeting space. And in the post-COVID world, there's a much looser relationship between yourself and your desk than there was in the past. So people float around the building and they work in different places. Sometimes they work in the kitchen, sometimes they work in the garden outside. And that 1954 building has actually quite wonderfully adapted to this more flexible working environment.
That's amazing. You know, we can see in a Quincy Jones building from our office here.
The barn?
The barn, right here. We're at the, Success Unscripted Studios on the 36th floor of 1999 Avenue of the Stars. And so we've got a window that's facing out to the west, see the ocean on a clear day, and then golf course.
That's,
of course.
It's so interesting that you've mentioned that. Of course, I knew that building because I knew Quincy and Elaine, and they were really the center of the art and design world. They were friends of Charles and Ray Eames. And that was another instance where, knowing Elaine, it was where Quincy and Elaine lived, as well as he had a studio there. And she got to the point in life where she actually needed to move into a care facility, and she needed to liquidate that project, that building. And as much as I would have loved to have acquired it myself, I had my Quincy Jones building, but I wanted to help her find someone that would preserve it. That building would be scraped immediately if it was just a market. It's a two-story building across the street from
the Century City Mall.
I introduced the building that opportunity to the Annenberg Foundation. And the Annenberg Foundation was one of Quincy's clients. He did Sunnylands, which was the great Annenberg estate in Rancho Mirage, for the ambassador and Mrs. Annenberg. There was a history between the Annenbergs and Quincy Jones. And the Annenberg Foundation acquired that building. And Metabolic Studio, which is Lauren Bond's, in a way, studio and creative incubator, uses that as a convening space and a space for visiting artists and things like that. So that another piece of LA architecture history is now safe.
On this show in particular, we really like to talk to people who have found great success, but also talk about the times that they struggled a little bit. We talked a little bit about this, like becoming what they call an accidental salesman. It's like, you know, you start out, you want to do architecture or whatever it is, or you're an artist, and then all of a sudden you find yourself, well, now I need someone to hire me, right? And you become a salesman. So talk to me about maybe some failures or struggles you had along the way.
Well, I think with any architecture, the profession is project-based. You don't have a project generally until somebody comes to you and says, I want you to do a project for me.
You're fired after every job.
Yeah, right. Basically.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of talent out there. And particularly in Los Angeles, and it's one of the things I love about it, tremendous amount of architectural talent. And so you're competing for every single project. So in any given year, you're going to fail most of the time to get a project. And every so often, maybe every few years, there's a project which you passionately believe is the right, you are the right person for, that you've got the right solution, you've got the right approach to it, and you love the people involved. And there's been some, and I would say every firm is the same, where we go right down to the wire.
Yeah.
And on one of those opportunities that we think is going to be career changing, it's going to make our next few years wonderful, it's going to be this great portfolio piece, and you don't get it.
Yeah.
And that can be really tough and
be devastating.
And you basically have to pick yourself up, dust off, and go back at it, because, you know, you have to keep bringing work in, because as wonderful as, and, you know, right now we're doing this enormous project at Princeton, which is just beginning construction. So there's a big team working on that. But once it goes into construction, it goes, reverts to a much smaller team. So we need to bring that next generation of work in.
Yeah.
We have some other projects that are coming to fruition now. So in a way, this is a time when there's a lot of uncertainty about the economy and interest rates. Yet at the same time, it's a vibrant time in terms of institutions building. And we're finding that there's a lot of opportunities out there. It's as at least as competitive as ever. We're finishing up some important local projects and around on the East Coast. Natural History Museum of Los Angeles gets close to 1 million visitors a year. And we've been working with them for the last few years on a major addition, which will be a new entry called the Commons. And for two new iconic pieces in their collection, a giant green sauropod, the only one of its kind in the world, because of the minerals in the ground where that dinosaur was embedded, the bones are green. Then there's a mural by an artist named Barbara Carrasco about Los Angeles history through the eyes of a Latinx population. And that was acquired by the museum a number of years ago when it was actually done as a public project in the 80s. And when she unveiled it, the government entity that commissioned it actually rejected it because it touched on some controversial social issues like the Japanese internment and farm workers' rights and things like that. And so it went into storage for decades, and the Natural History Museum acquired it, and now is going to be on display in this public gallery, which, is, by the way, is in front of the paywall. So that will, the museum has substantial assets available to anybody that comes in, even without paying admission. And that new building is basically facing the Lucas Museum, which is a few years out in Exposition Park. And the other project I just wanted to mention that we're opening this fall is the Vassar Inn and Institute. Vassar being a liberal arts college, it's something that I believe passionately in. I wanted to create an institute that would promote the liberal arts approach to intellectual pursuits. And so they wanted to build a boutique hotel and a convening center at Vassar College. And we just finished that, and that opens in October.
So, yeah, so Vassar opens October. Natural History Museum opens November, right? Yeah,
correct.
Okay, wonderful. That's fantastic. What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
It's all about people. I think it's one of the great gifts of life is the people that come into your life, and that at any stage in your life, there will be new people, and they are your greatest treasure. And maintaining those relationships, cultivating those relationships, being open to those relationships, to me, is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's great advice. We will check out the openings of these, and we'll put them on our social media.
Great, John.
Help promote them. Yeah, no, thank you. Where can people find you? Are you on social media?
We are on Instagram, Frederick Fisher and Partners, and our website, www.frederickfisherandpartners.net. And type my name into the web and find me pretty easily.
Yeah, Frederick Fisher. It's been an honor to have you on and to meet you in person. Thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate what you're doing. I think these kinds of conversations are really important and certainly adds to my day.
Thanks for listening to today's conversation. Fred explained how he creates custom projects to service the individual needs of his clients. In that way, I see a lot of similarity between what he does in architecture and what I do in financial planning. If you're not working with someone who is taking your individual needs into account, feel free to reach out to me at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Now, here's a short success story about someone you might know. On May 27, 1968, Company K launched a daring assault on Goi Noi Island, clashing with a fortified North Vietnamese battalion. As enemy mortars rained down, Frank, now a lieutenant, charged through the chaos, rescuing wounded Marines and rallying his men. Born in Marks, Mississippi, Fred's father, who founded Dixie Greyhound Lines, passed away when he was about four, leaving him to be raised by his mother and uncles. Crippled by bone disease as a small boy, he regained his health by the age of 10 and became an amateur pilot as a teen. It's only been 2 years since graduating from Yale with a degree in economics, where he was friends with George W. Bush and John Kerry, now finding himself calling in artillery and airstrikes and orchestrating an attack against the North Vietnamese at their weakest flank, leading to the capture of two soldiers and crucial intelligence, a feat that earned him a Silver Star, Bronze Star, and two Purple Hearts. After his time at war, Fred got busy building a business, using a plan he developed while at Yale. He wrote the blueprint for his business in a term paper for an economics class, which received a C grade from the professor, who said the idea was unfeasible. In 1970, he acquired a controlling interest in ARC Aviation Sales and trained his focus on trading used jets. By 1973, his company was operational in 25 cities with a fleet of 14 Dassault Falcon 20 jets. In the early days, Fred faced significant challenges to keep the company running. At one point, after a vital business loan was turned down, he took the last $5,000 the company had to Las Vegas and successfully won $27,000 playing blackjack, which helped him pay a $24,000 fuel bill and keep the company operational for another week. His scrappiness paid dividends, as he was ultimately able to grow the business into a multi-billion dollar operation. Fred was named CEO of the Year in 2004 by Chief Executive Magazine, and in 2014, Fortune Magazine ranked him 26th amongst the list of the world's 50 greatest leaders. And that's the story of how Fred Smith, a boy from Marks, Mississippi, defied the odds in war, in business, and even at the blackjack table to create a company called Federal Express, better known today as FedEx. And that's the way he did it. Thank you again for listening, and a special thank you to producer Jake, content manager Angeline, and everyone else who made this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode of Success Unscripted, please like and share. If you have feedback, or if you or someone you know would be a good guest for our show, please reach out to us at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.